welcome to the World of Foundational Horror Podcast, episode 92. I'm Christina, and this is the podcast where I take a tour of classic international horror. On the main pod, Mac and I choose a genre or subgenre of horror and pair an international film with an American one. With these minis, I want to fill in the gaps of my own knowledge and find those foundational films that have influenced and inspired modern horror. The only rules for this project are that the movie has to have been made before the year 2000 and it must not have been made in the U.S. The topic for this mini is Don't Look Now from 1973. To help me discuss and dissect this classic is the original friend of the show, Quinn McLaughlin. Welcome, Quinn.
Hi, thank you. Thank you so much for having me here. It's an honor.
Thank you for being here. It's my honor and pleasure. Mutual. So in terms of disclaimers, wohos, we will probably swear. I'm probably going to swear. Can't vouch for Quinn over there.
There will be swears, yeah.
And we will spoil everything, including the ending of this movie. This movie was directed by Nicholas Roeg. The screenplay was by Alan Scott and Chris Bryant, based on Don't Look Now, by Daphne du Maurier, and it stars Julie Christie and Donald Sutherland. The release date was the 16th of October, 1973, and has a running time of 110 minutes. So I was four in 1973. I wonder if I had a costume.
Oh, I bet you did.
I wonder what it was.
And it's probably, looking back, something creepy, because yeah. It's very 70s.
Yeah. Also, my parents were splitting up, so I'm not sure if they were...
It may have been a paper mask.
Oh, yeah. You know what? My sister Libby went as a member of KISS one year.
Whoa.
Like, I don't know which one, but she had one of those plastic masks.
Yeah. My brother and I were like the same things, you know, on and off. So that costume, you know, when the costume fit him and then it fit me later. One of those costumes, sadly, was the Pillsbury Doughboy.
Oh, wow.
That's like such a bad thing for a chunky kid to be, the Pillsbury Doughboy. And it was when there were all those commercials where people would push their finger into the doughboy's stomach and he would go, hee hee. Oh my God, it was so fucking embarrassing. It was a great costume, honestly, but it's just not something that should have been.
Did your mother make it?
Yep, she made it. Yeah.
The brief plot summary from IMDb says. I think for this mini, it's not really going to be a mini. But I thought instead of calling it that word we don't like, we'll call it a mega.
Yeah.
It's not a mini, it's a mega. And I think we should just like interject random facts about ourselves during this mega.
Okay. Well, I started. So yeah.
The plot from IMDb says a married couple grieving the recent death of their young daughter are in Venice when they encounter two elderly sisters, one of whom is psychic and brings a warning from beyond. Yeah. Quinn, I think I know, but what's your history with this film?
I first saw this film when I was a freshman in college, so maybe around 2000. And this one was, again, featured in my wonderful intro to film class that was actually intro to film, the horror version. So it was all horror films and very much like different genres, but he really loved the 70s. So we did watch a lot of 70s horror, and this was one of them. And it stayed with me. And I remember, I think it just stayed with me for the tone more and the atmosphere, less so plot wise. Yeah, that was the first time I watched it. And then I suggested it for Squad a while back, and we all watched it together. And was that your first watch then?
It was, as a matter of fact. I was not acquainted with this movie, and I've since seen it probably about four more times. But I have to say that after the first watch, I was only lukewarm about it. But now I freaking love it.
I do too. We talked a little bit about this before, but we both kind of agree that it's one of those films that you kind of have to watch maybe a few times and maybe in close succession and to really maybe fully fill in the gaps and grasp it. And I mean, again, it's just my interpretation of what I grasp, which is, it's vast and probably has many interpretations, but yeah, I think it's just like a great piece of art. You can see it kind of standing back and not taking it in and know that it is cool in ways in which it sets this tone. It makes you feel a certain way. It is engaging. And I think it keeps your attention the entire time. But then once you maybe step a little bit closer and start going deeper, it just gets better and better. So you could stand far away and appreciate it and be like, I got it. Or you could go closer and really kind of take it in all of its like corners and alleys and all that good stuff and kind of become something different.
I completely agree with you. And I just rewatched the opening scene today. And well, Johnny's bike is red. Christine's tights are red. There's a whole lot of red in that very first scene. And I had noticed this maybe around the third watch, but I love the opening scene. I think it's a masterpiece. And you probably saw this way before I did, but there's a hooded figure that's sitting in the slide that John is looking at. And when he spills whatever he spills onto his projector, the red just sort of does this like weird little swirl, but it starts at the figure's head and it kind of swirls around. And I hadn't thought about this before, but I read somewhere that this might be a riff on Little Red Riding Hood. And John, not to skip ahead, but I will, in the story especially, in the short story especially, wants to protect the hooded figure because he believes it to be a child. And spoiler, it isn't. So actually the hooded figure is the danger. She's not in danger.
Oh, yeah. Well, I like that. That was very well said. Just this last time, I just started thinking a lot about destiny and if this, you know, if this film is also attempting to highlight the concept of destiny, because, you know, in the beginning, he is looking at the slides and of course the montage in the beginning, which I think is beautiful and perfect as well. But you do see the hooded figure in the slide and then the water spills and the ink, you know, draws this sort of circle in red. And when the film ends, you know, the whole time throughout the film when they're in Venice, there's this kind of lurking danger in the background that is this murderer is killing folks. And it's not a huge deal within the film. It doesn't really steer the plot in many ways, but it's in the background and it's lurking and it's this danger. And in the end, he gets all of these signs and these messages that he ignores. And we can talk about that more, but the murderer kills him. And so, and it is this little person in a red hood, you know, that again, he is seeing as a child and maybe as Christine, his daughter who died in the beginning, you know, in the end, he's like, I'm a friend. And, you know, she turns to him and shakes her head no. And it just feels like, you idiot. Like, you had so many chances to receive messages and you weren't open. So then it feels like kind of like the idea of destiny, and you're presented with a destiny that can either happen or not, but is going to happen a certain way if you don't do something big to change something. And he doesn't really do that thing, which is maybe accepting this vulnerability or whatever. And so it happens. And he is killed by this person or this danger that he is first introduced to in the beginning. It's like Final Destination, like it's going to happen type of thing. And throughout the film, we kind of like, he almost dies a couple of times. You know, his life does feel like it is in danger. And
he's warned verbally by the psychic lady that he is in danger. But the fact that he almost falls off that scaffolding, I would take that as another warning. And the fact that Johnny gets sick seems to suggest that maybe y'all should go back home and take care of your other child. But he doesn't do any of those things. And so he's caught up in the danger. He chases it too.
Yeah.
I mean, he doesn't recognize it as danger, obviously, but he puts himself in danger.
Yeah, absolutely. He puts himself in danger in so many different ways. But I mean, I guess we could also argue like a big danger too that is presented here is like the rigidity of human nature and the idea that, you know, you can't see it from someone else's side. You can't see another perspective of something. You're very closed off to everything. And, you know, when you think about that in and of itself, it is really a terrible, detrimental quality. And it is really dangerous in so many ways, or it can present as very dangerous. You're right. He's told to stay away, that he is in danger, you know, even when she goes home to, you know, check in on the son, his boss, the bishop, tells him, you should have gone with her. You should have left.
Right.
Yeah. And then did you notice, I don't know if we talked about this ever, but did you notice that after the near fall on the scaffolding, like, so if the movie sort of provides all of these flashes, sort of where you're seeing things happen that already happened or that will happen or that are happening or that could have happened in a different way even. So this viewing, I kind of noticed some of those things. And one of them is that after he does almost fall in a scene, maybe like 5 minutes later, he gets a flash of him actually falling and it's really quick. And I don't know. I wrote that in my notes and I don't think I talked about it to you, but it's really interesting. And I think it further serves as evidence that this film is so not linear. You know, it's like, it's right. Just like very dreamlike or nightmare-like almost, like things are happening mm-hmm. at one time or another time, or they did happen. And I don't know, when you get to the end of it, I think it's kind of an interesting idea to think of it as like, if you believe in the idea that before you die, you get like this flash, kind of could be something like that. You know, I know it's not, and that's a cop out to be like, the whole thing was just the flash of his whole life, you know, and I don't think that about this, but I think it could be argued that it could be a version of something like that.
You know, in the short story, the line is something like, as he's dying and he's thinking of Laura on the vaporetto, he realizes it hasn't happened in the past. It's going to happen like tomorrow or the day after tomorrow. And the reason is because it's going to be his funeral. And there was a website I looked at called demaurier.org. And there was an essay about this. And they were saying that the director with the sex scene and then with this one is sort of, like you were saying, is not presenting time in a linear way. It's like it's all happening all at the same time. Everything's happening all at the same time. And I did not notice the flash of him falling, but that might seem to suggest an alternate timeline. And that's pretty cool if that's what Rogue was doing, because you never see that. But I think about that all the time, all the time.
Yeah.
You know, like I think about like the other day I was driving and I had to brake fast. So I'm like, what if, you know, I would have gotten into a car crash in that moment. Thank goodness I didn't, but I could have. So if that's, I'm not sure that's what he was doing. But if so, I think that's really interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know either. So, like, more evidence of that kind of idea and thinking and concept. I don't think, I think that's so difficult to do, to suggest it even, you know, if it's not completely all about, you know, a different timeline or something like that. It's a very vague suggestion here, but I kind of like it. I like the idea. And I was thinking a lot about shots, and I mean, I feel like we could have a whole podcast on this film and like go through like cinematography, mise-en-scene, editing, whatever. We don't have time for all of that because like it would be an alternate timeline for us. But he does do this thing where he's, you know, within a shot or within a scene, it's shot from one angle and then it backs up a couple seconds and it's shot again from maybe like a little bit lower. But, you know, on the same plane, the same shot, the same scene, within the same scene where he's like rewinding a little bit, you know, or I don't know, not rewinding necessarily, but just like an alternate angle that is very similar, but very different. And the one that sticks out to me the most is when he's sending Laura off to England to check on the son. She's getting on a gondola for the airport and it's showing, it's like showing this low angle shot of the two of them talking right before she gets on the gondola, but it's from within the gondola. And so it's through the window and the window is like kind of all sort of blurred, fuzzy, like cracked a little bit. And then, you know, for about 3 seconds, it's shot from, you know, within, and then 3 seconds later, you see it from outside the gondola and it's clear and it's still the same angle, but it's the barrier is taken away and everything is clear. And yeah, even that subtle kind of focus of showing the same angle and the same shot, just with something, you know, something in between, something obstructing, I think says a lot about like a very subtle layer, like under layer of a maybe different timeline, you know, like a little bit dirtier, grittier from behind the window versus clear from outside.
The use of glass, I think, is really important in this movie. And so definitely we could do a deeper dive and sort of analyze. Like, I mean, I feel like you could watch this movie just for color, or you could watch this movie just for all the instances of glass. The scene that sticks out to me is when he's on the scaffolding and you actually get a shot that's very high angle. And then there's a shot of the piece of wood that's coming toward his face. And I mean, all these crazy angles just in that one scene, which is chaotic anyway, because he's lost his balance. There's some glass that has broken. And so he's really in danger. And the bishop is below thinking about his own father's death, which we learn a couple minutes later was caused by a fall. But all of those different angles, when I think about how dangerous apparently this actually was, I just want to know how long Donald Sutherland was up there, you know, and they were getting all these different shots. But just thinking about the film itself, you know, here's another instance where we're just seeing the same action, but we're seeing it from all these different perspectives.
Yeah, that's a good point, because he would have had to be up. There would have been a lot of takes.
Yeah.
That would have been necessary to use for footage.
But I mean, stuff I hadn't even thought about until, like, Wohos, if you haven't seen this film, freaking see it. But also, that first scene has so much in it that I didn't even realize. Like, even the stupid question that Christine has asked, if the world is round, how can the frozen pond be flat? Even that is another instance of, like, barriers and glass and things appearing one way and actually being another way. It's all right fucking there in that very first scene.
Yeah. That's genius. So cool. Because, yeah, that's such a great point. Because glass, you think of ice and then water underneath it. Of course, she, you know, in the film version, drowns. Then they're in Venice. You know, the whole foundation is water. But if you think about water in its states and what it can be, you know, like a solid, a liquid, gas, right? I mean, particles, whatever, the idea that it can be so many different things, but also the symbolic nature of water, like cleansing, purification,
baptism, rebirth.
Yeah, like religiously, it's very symbolic and really important. But then when you add like the glass with the water and you think about like a frozen body of water, you know, like it becomes dangerous in a different way, which water could be dangerous too. But yeah, no, I love that so much. And I also, you know, her looking up the question and saying that question, even I just feel like I love the question, but what's, I think even more important to me about that question is the care that they take with it. They're really, you know, she's concerned and wants to find the answer to be able to tell Christine. And he remarks, what a good question. And you can tell he means that. And I think it sets up, you know, I like this couple. There's things I don't love about their relationship and things that are like red flag. But in the state of what they're going through, there's nothing, there's nothing too red flaggy. I don't know. I mean, I don't know the proper protocol to handle something like this. So for me, I think he paints a really nice picture of a couple who have a nice partnership and care about each other and care about their kids. I mean, to a degree, you can say, what happened to the boy? You know, but.
Well, I mean, I feel like if you do place it in Du Maurier's time, children weren't really considered to be people until maybe the 1970s. Definitely not in Du Maurier's time. I feel like in the short story, that Christine is 5. And so she's closer to a baby than, you know, to Johnny, who is school age and he's at boarding school. I never understood boarding schools anyway. Like, how could you be away from your child for so long? But I mean, lots of people do it. I don't, that's not my experience. And the thought of me being separated from my kids, you know, like that, I would hate it. But anyway, in any case, sidebar. But so in the book, it's much that age difference is maybe accentuated a little more, plus the girl and the boy thing and, you know, all this other stuff. But I agree with you. I think that's really sweet. And there is a shot of Donald Sutherland just sort of looking at his wife in that very first scene. He just is like, he looks at her and smiles and God damn it. You know, that's a beautiful moment to witness, to see somebody just sort of enjoying their partner working or, you know, just sitting there, whatever she was doing. And I just love that moment.
I do too. And I don't know. To me, that beginning montage does something that the sex scene does as well. And I think that just further establishes their attention and care for each other, which is important because there's a lot of films that, you know, if there's a focus on horror or suspense or a certain story or a narrative or plot, like sometimes characterization falls by the wayside. But if I don't understand or buy into some of the power dynamic of characters, then I kind of feel lost in a way, or like just I'm disconnected. So something that he does presents these two in such an organic way that makes me feel like they're more so real than other couples that I see, you know, portrayed in TV and film, especially when the emphasis is on like the tone and the story and everything. And I think he just does a really good job developing, or with these actors are great. I mean, they do a great job. Mm-hmm. They're the ones doing the great job, but I feel like Rogue is concerned with this story being presented in such a way. And that way includes that we feel like these two characters are connected, not just, you know, married, but actually have a relationship and a partnership.
I think it's interesting that the first scene and the sex scene were additions by Rogue. And those are probably, you could pick out those two scenes as, you know, demonstrating what this couple is all about. Obviously, they get into little arguments and deep disagreements about, you know, metaphysical reality. So they don't see the world in the same way. And that's important. But that doesn't spell the end of the relationship. That just means they have a complicated relationship. And I feel that's missing from a lot of portrayals of couples. And so I think he really did a fantastic job. That first scene, I think, is 7 minutes. And I'm not sure how long the sex scene is. I mean, that's a lot of work that's done in a very short amount of time.
Yeah. You know, one thing too, this is not necessarily a bad thing, but it's kind of to add that scene, that beginning scene, the opening sequence, that's a tough scene to put at the beginning of a film because it's really disorienting. And when you throw something like that at audiences, like their gut is to disconnect and not, you know, like not latch in for this ride. I think it's really disorienting. And I think it's tough. That's the only part. I love it when I go back to it. But when I'm first watching the film, I think that that's a risky move to put that as the opening. I don't know how else he would have done it. And that scene is so gorgeous. The montage is so gorgeous and it's so meaningful and so powerful. But it's tough to open a film like that.
And the short story is different in that we start in Venice, but the couple's on vacation. You know, Rogue made the change to have John working. It's sort of like, it's sort of like fanfic, but like in the coolest way, because you can tell he loves the story, but he's like, he's expanded it. Oh, there's a quote. It's way at the bottom of the doc. I really loved it on that website again. Ben Wheatley is quoted as saying, "Don't look now is a quote kaleidoscope of meaning." And that is so beautifully put. And it's like we were saying before, full disclosure, Wohos, we lost the first recording that we did of this podcast. So we're having this conversation again, but it's different. You don't need to know that. Why am I telling you that? Anyway.
Yeah, but it is completely different,
It is completely different. But like, it's like we were saying, you know, it's having the same scene shot from different angles, having the flashes of imagery that you're not really sure what you just saw all fits in with this idea of the film being a kaleidoscope of meaning. Yeah. I really like that.
And I feel like there's the flashes sometimes are like slivers too, which is furthermore kaleidoscopy. I love that. The kaleidoscope comment. I love that.
Maybe we could just talk a little more about the couple. I mean, one thing I find interesting, we don't really know what Laura believed before she meets the psychic woman. But after that meeting, Laura feels great. She's not depressed anymore because she's convinced that her dead daughter is happy on the other side and is communicating or trying to communicate to John and her that, you know, she's with them. And she believes that, and John rejects that idea completely.
For clarity, if you've seen the film, like if you haven't seen the film, you know, hopefully you've heard Christina say, just go watch it. But if you have seen it and maybe are forgetting pieces of the plot, because this movie does that to you. I feel like it gives you amnesia in a way. But in the beginning, they're just going to dinner and they're kind of focused on these two women who are just at another table. And he opens the window. Something flies into one of the women's eye. They go and they try to find the bathroom. Laura helps them find the bathroom. And she says, that's when this all happens. And the sisters, their older sisters, Heather and Wendy. And I think Heather is the psychic one. And she's also blind. So, you know, it's kind of noted that, like, different senses are enhanced, of course, and her abilities. It's easier to see. But yeah, I don't know where I was going with that. I think I just wanted to clarify that this, there's so few plot points in the film, really. I just thought to sort of iron that out, just that this is where they meet them. And then, of course, as you just said, you know, Laura is just overjoyed with this message that Christine sends through Heather, and John is not. He doesn't like, you know, he says, she's dead, she's dead, she's dead, and doesn't believe in this type of thing and doesn't like this kind of crutch, I guess, perhaps, that Laura is leaning on. And then they just kind of keep running into these sisters. They're kind of all over the place. And, you know, at one point, Laura is with him while he is working on scaffolding. And out of the corner of his eye, he sees the two sisters and he sees Laura and she's like moving closer to them. And he's kind of just like, I don't know. I think you think he's going to fall at that moment, but, he sees them and is kind of, he gets upset then, and they get into a fight because of it. And, you know, eventually she goes to their hotel and they kind of have this seance of sorts. And that is when the message comes across that John's in danger, that his life is in danger in Venice.
They get the message that there's an opportunity for them to leave when their son, Johnny, becomes injured and he's at boarding school in England. Laura goes, and in the short story, John's just right behind her. But of course, we know he doesn't make it. But the other thing that the psychic lady says is that John himself is psychic. And I feel like John is so dismissive and contemptuous of this idea. He has such a disdain for these ideas that these supernatural things exist. It's kind of funny that he's working on churches because he doesn't have a religion himself. And he even makes a comment at one point where he says, I don't like this church. So he's just presented as just somebody who's just like cold and logical. And as you were talking, I was thinking, what's his alternative? Like, Laura is trying to deal with her grief, but what's his alternative? Like, don't deal with it at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think I get this idea that he thinks he's dealt with it, you know, and I think that he doesn't have an alternative because he thinks that he's already through that process. And I don't think that I think he's the type of person that probably doesn't think that everyone needs a process, even if the process is, you know, looks completely different for different people. I don't think he would accept that either. I think he's one of those people that have this idea of what is supposed to happen. And, you know, maybe it would take someone else a little bit longer or shorter, but they're going to do it in the same way. And I don't like those people.
Those are tough people. But I mean, those are people of, like, my parents' generation and a little older, you know? And so, I don't know, those would be somewhere in the range of your grandparents. But, and it makes sense. I get that. My grandfather, my mother's father, was a sweet man, but in terms of emotions, he didn't have a lot of time for them. And I don't think he thought they were good for much. You know, you've got things you've got to do, and you're right. I mean, things should be done in a certain way, and that could involve doing things with integrity and with honor. I think he had a lot of principles, but emoting was not his strong suit, and I don't think he was ever comfortable when he was around other people who were doing that. And so John sort of reminds me of that way of living, you know. Yeah.
I think that is, there's some evidence there too at the, during the scene after she goes to the seance, right before they get the call about the sun having fallen, where, you know, he says something, she mentions something about taking her pills again. And he said, yeah, you should be doing that. And then she grabs one and like slips it under her sleeve. But with what you just said, I think it connects to the idea that, yeah, make it better. Just make it better now. Do that. Turn that off. Take that pill. Then we're done with that. You know, move on.
But also in that scene, she's like, okay, if you don't believe this stuff, then you must think I'm mad. And he goes, yes. And then she's like, oh, so I guess I should, you know, take my medicine. And he's like, yes. Like he's very impatient. Like, finally, you're getting it, you know, that kind of way of dealing with her. And maybe he thinks he's been really patient. But to me, in that scene, he just seems like a fucking asshole. But I mean, it's probably not his fault that he is the way he is. I just feel like she's presented as very emotional and very open-minded. And he is sort of the opposite.
Yeah. And I think that the way that she's presented within the film, for me, and I don't know if it's me as a woman or just me as like a viewer in, you know, 2022, I don't find her to be at all like off kilter, or I don't even think she's emotional really. Like, I wouldn't even say that. I see her sort of grasping onto this idea that this woman has a message from her daughter and she's happy. And why wouldn't she want to grasp onto that? You know, like as a parent of a young child who died in an accident on your property, I mean, that would be everything. And I see that as everything. And I would want that for anyone who experiences that kind of loss to have this kind of, you know, message that everything's okay. I mean, that would be everything. And I don't know. It's tough to see him react that harshly to the idea that she's interested in this message and that she's interested mm-hmm. in finding out more. And it is like this beautiful presentation of faith versus lack of faith. And it can be applied to so many different things in the movie, I think. But obviously, we're asked to think about it religiously in a way, because while neither of them, I think, are religious, I mean, I don't think she really is, and we know that he isn't. Obviously, Catholicism is an important plot point in the film, or at least structurally it is, you know, again, as he works for the church, and they are in Venice, and they are talking to the bishop, who also, as with the two sisters, feels very creepy. I mean, I have it in my notes, why is the bishop so creepy? But that's, I think it's something we talked about on the Lost podcast, but the idea that we are seeing it from John's perspective, and he is coming into contact with people and they are maybe acting a little bit weird, or we see that, we see his reaction, we see it from his perspective, but mm-hmm. you know, no one is out to get him. When you first watch this film, you think everyone is out to get him. You know, the sisters, the bishop, the hotel owner, the detective, everyone just feels very off kilter. But really, they're all sort of, I think, structurally there to reinforce this message of get the fuck out of here, or be open and vulnerable to messages, at least, you know?
I agree with you. And you had mentioned on the last pod that there aren't subtitles that are provided. So if you don't know any Italian, you're just as in the dark as our characters. And, you know, I think John does that thing that we all do when we are like in close proximity to people speaking in a language we don't understand. We assume they're talking about us, you know, and I think he assumes that everyone is, he just has this paranoia, you know, and I think, you know, it's just sort of expanded out in terms of the police detective and the bishop and the sisters and even the hotel owner, who's just like a sweet, sweet man who just wants to have a little vacation.
Yeah. yeah. And then the scene, the setting as well, the never ending alleyways, the corners, the dark corners that you can turn and be in complete darkness and then turn again and it be like a lit street scene and the water and yeah, like everything adds to that, which is beautiful.
Yeah.
When it does.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a great setting. I've never been to Venice, but I know that Rogue was careful not to film in like touristy sections. You know, he's sort of, you know, showing these dingy spaces in some cases. I mean, it's just not glamorized. It's not a travelogue. He's just showing us the experience of these characters. I think it is interesting that the bishop says something like, I don't want to believe the premonitions, but I have no choice. And I think John is so confused by that. And I have to say, I think I'm a little confused by that.
So after he is killed, after John is killed, everyone seems to know it, even though they don't see it. They're not right there. And it cuts to the bishop waking up in the middle of the night. So that, I feel like, is the evidence that he is there as well. And maybe it's like all of these characters that are highlighted, maybe even the detective have it in some way or have this sense of knowing, the spiritual sense. And it's, do you accept it and develop it, or do you close it off and it just becomes sort of a creepy world of interactions, which that's what it is for him. Because he's so tightly closed to the door.
Oh, my mind's just like spinning.
This is such a good, it's just, it's so layered and there's so much there. And like, I am completely stunned that our conversation is so completely different than it was 2 days ago.
I know. If we're going to talk tomorrow, it would probably be different again.
Yeah.
But I mean, I feel like this film, and I had no idea, as I said, the first time I watched it, that it would be the kind of movie I would want to talk about. But it's an interesting horror film in that, yes, there's a grisly death in it, but it's more unsettling. And also the backstory of the tragedy, I mean, that's horrifying, you know, the thought of losing a child is horrifying and sort of examining this couple and how they're dealing with it or not dealing with it. I wanted to mention the part where she brings it back up to him and she says, well, you were the one who said they should play outside. And he says, thanks for the memories, Laura. And I think he doesn't want to. I mean, who would? But he doesn't want to remember that. And it's, I think you're right in that that's done. That's over. That's in the past. Like, why are we still talking about it? Whereas, you know, it's much healthier to acknowledge that I'm still feeling very sad and very confused by this event that happened that, you know, ripped my whole world apart.
Yeah. And if he is the one that suggested that the kids or allowed the kids to play by the water, he takes on some of the blame, which is, I want him to accept the message even more so, because that will kill you, that guilt,
And you might be blinded in your guilt to seeing the truth. Weather and Hendy.
Why is her name Heather? So Heather is like, I don't know, such a super common name for kids I knew growing up. And my best friend's name is Heather. And it's so funny to see this old blind British woman in a 1973 movie named Heather. It's very, I can't accept it. I cannot accept it, but I do and I will, but it's hard.
I mean, if she was born, you know, at the turn of the century, maybe, or even in the 1910s, you know, maybe that was a really popular name at that time. And it just sort of, you know, just came around again. And a bunch of people in the 80s named their kids Heather. And maybe it's just an unusual name.
We should just quickly also talk about those two. Like,
yeah.
I don't know. You throw those two in a movie, you're going to get some, you're going to get some anxiety and suspicion. And I think that, you know, when we first see them, it's really easy to assume that these are like just sweet old ladies who are passing on a message, kind of like, what the Long Island medium does. She's going to Greensboro, by the way.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I think she's a charlatan.
Okay. You heard it here first. yeah, or like John Edwards or whatever, you know. And
definitely
they have shows where they like see people at a gas station and they're like, I need to tell you a message, you know, and that's what this is like. Yeah. But it's a little bit different because of the setting and, you know, just the women are not, they're not like flashy with big New Jersey hair or anything. You know, they are these like sweeter, older women and they are giving a sweet little message. But then as time goes on, you know, like you see them more and they do feel like they're lurking in the background of everything that's going on in Venice. And then when Laura goes up to their hotel for the Zans, I just found that scene to be really weird. And that sort of started to really spark my distrust of those two, even though there's no reason to distrust them. But he does, or Daphne du Maurier maybe like really does set it up to kind of be a little suspicious of them. You know, they always have like a drink that they're offering, which is not suspicious, but it feels that way. They have these photographs on their dresser, you know, like maybe 10 of them. And they kind of take Laura through who they are, but we don't really know who they are in relation to them. They're like, this is little Eddie. And, you know, and then I don't know, their whole kind of like script of getting going is kind of fishy to me. And then also at another point, they say, Heather says, I don't bring, this is not a quote, I don't have the quote written down, but it's something like paraphrase of, I don't try to grab the dead for the living's entertainment.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And Laura's like, well, it wouldn't be my entertainment, you know? And she's kind of like, what the hell? I didn't mean that. But also, you gave me this message, you know. I don't know.
I mean, I do think, okay, I don't know how much research Nicholas Rogue did. There was something in the trivia about him going to a seance or encouraging Julie Christie to go to one. And we talked about this, that at that real seance that Christie went to, they said to open their legs, uncross the legs. And we had a discussion about what that might mean. But I mean, I think that those people, this sounds terrible, but I feel like kind of people who claim to be in touch with the spiritual realm, let's just say, can be a little weird. Well, let's face it, everyone can be a little weird. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But the fact that she's blind and she's saying she's a psychic, I think maybe we're looking for weirdness or...
Yeah. And I mean, obviously they freak out John to a degree that, you know, when Laura goes home and he thinks that she didn't actually go home and that she's missing in Venice at one point, you know, he goes into the police station and explains the whole story to the inspector. And then he gets those two arrested. So there's enough there, at least, that he's concerned. And there's enough there that they take it to the next level and actually go and arrest these two.
Yeah, that's weird to
me. I know, it is kind of weird.
It's kind of a weird hole, I think. Although it does sort of soften John up, I think, after that, because he walks them home.
Yeah, he walks Heather home.
But he doesn't accept the drink.
He says he would have water. Does he drink water, though?
I don't remember him drinking anything. I just feel like that's another part of his character where it's like, this isn't that. Like, this is not social time. This is me dropping you off. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
Our business is conducted. You know, we're not going to share a cocktail, for God's sake.
Yeah, that's when Wendy realizes that Heather is starting to go into, like, a bit of a trance
seizure,
mm-hmm. you know, that leads to maybe something else.
And then, that's when Heather's like, fetch him back.
Let him not leave. Now when she says, let him not leave, it's like, come on, Heather, let's talk about active voice. No. fetch him back. And then that's when he you know, starts following the hooded figure then, and that's his demise. That's the end of him.
Should we talk about some trivia?
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay, let's talk about the sex scene. So apparently Donald Sutherland and Julie Christie met for the first time on the set of this film, and the sex scene was the first thing that was filmed, as Nicholas Rogue wanted to, quote, get it out of the way, which I completely understand. But, and we disagree about how we feel about the sex scene. I think it is awkward. In the short story, this is the first sex they've had since the death of their child. But I think it looks like two actors who don't know each other. And I don't like it.
I think it is awkward too. I don't disagree with you on that. I just really like it. I don't know why I love it so much. I believe I was able to articulate that in the Lost Pod, but I don't know. Now I just, when I think about it, I think I have warm feelings of it. I like where it goes. And I think logistically sex can be awkward, or getting it started or ending it sometimes, or like moving around in the middle of it. And then like, I don't know. Yeah.
I just think it's fun and funny. I mean, I guess I agree with you, but I just feel like you're sharing this moment. Like, I think passionate sex scenes are hilarious, because I that's not the way I have sex. I mean, there's often laughing involved.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just like, you know, it's just fucking fun.
But isn't it so, more realistic than those passionate love affairs?
Yes. Yes. I will grant you that. Yes. But I just feel like, I guess it's just the one part that I don't like. It's the rolling around part.
Okay.
I just think that looks really awkward. And also, I think she touches his butt in a really like tentative way. And I'm like, she wouldn't touch him like that. She'd be like, she'd either grab him or like stroke. I mean, it just seems like she's kind of like, eh.
Okay. I don't remember the butt touching, but I
I could have made it up too. I don't know.
I like the rolling around and the different angles. And I even like that they did not clear the bed of the newspaper. I love that.
Yeah.
I think that's realistic, even though it would not be something I would do. I would clear the bed of the newspaper. I think that's kind of gross. But I think that is a beautiful detail of the realism of this. And I like the rolling around and the different angles. And I like it that you sometimes don't know what you're looking at in this scene, which is like kind of amazingly brilliant, because we are not all naked bodies. Like, so I don't see everyone naked all day. So sometimes if I'm looking at something, maybe I don't know exactly what it is for a second. And I think that's a cool thing to do in a film. But I also love the fucking editing, which I think is without saying is brilliant. And I love the parallel of them having this awkward, weird sex, but it being parallel to them getting ready to go to dinner. And when they're getting ready to go to dinner, I don't think it's about them getting ready, or I don't think it's about paralleling it to something or making a parallel to something that's mundane like that. I think it's more about the reactions of their faces based on what just happened, because it is not, I mean, sex is not monumental, right? But this connection.
Oh, it is.
Well, it is it monumental, is. But I don't know. I think that it can be monumental, right? Or it can be mundane. We're not supposed to see this as a mundane act, but we're supposed to compare it to a mundane act, which is getting ready, which is when you probably could feel, I don't know, like way less self-conscious than when having sex. So you can understand the sort of like the looks on their faces and the connection that they have and like the stability that it just created for them, because they are in a tumultuous spot with each other, you know, and whether or not it's the first time they've had sex since their daughters died, it's still a moment that's like, it's rocky because they are grieving, whether they say it or not, you know, whether John says it or not, he is, whether Laura says it or not, she is, and we know she is, and also she's got this message from him. But I love that we come to understand after this scene, because of the inner cutting of them getting ready, that they have this care and affection for each other that is powerful. And to me, that's, I love that. I love it because of that. And it really does something similar than that the beginning of the movie does, when they simply are interacting with each other without the death of their daughter, when it's just, we just had lunch and we're just having a normal day. But
sex is probably really important to him. And it's like the way that he can connect the best with her. I mean, sitting and working on those slides, they seem pretty connected.
Yeah. But I think when we see their bodies physically intertwined in ways that maybe seem awkward.
Yeah.
Then I think it hammers home that point even further. That is important, and it is necessary that their bodies come together in that way. You know, like, doesn't have to be that way, but I like what he did with it being that way and it being awkward and them being rolling around on a newspaper and all these different angles. It just feels chaotic too, though, which sometimes that's what sex is too. Can be.
Well, as you may have heard, WoHos, there were rumors at the time that there was penetrative sex. There wasn't. But apparently Warren Beatty believed the rumors. He was dating Julie Christie at the time, and he punched Rogue in the face at a party. And I think that is so crazy that that happened. Yeah, I mean, people kind of didn't know what to do with this sex scene. It was completely removed by the Irish censor when it was released in Ireland. And 9 frames, which is less than half a second, had to be cut from the scene in order to avoid an X certificate in the U.S. So, and it's one of the first times cunnilingus is depicted in a major feature film. And that's pretty great, actually. Thinking about 73, it probably was pretty shocking.
Yeah. And that's cool, too, because, like, it does, like, that's, I think that's a very, I think that's important to suggest or allude to in any sex scene that has to be there, you know, and I think that's also stressing even more so their relationship and the importance that he places on her stability and her, you know.
Well, he loves her.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's clear that he loves her, but I feel like all of his anger is kind of coming out sideways because he hasn't dealt with his grief, you know? But, I mean, underneath it, everything, I think he really does love her very much.
Yeah, I do too. And I think you're right. It's just kind of spilling out all over the place.
Yeah, it's messy.
It's messy. When there is like a clear and present gift that if he just were to grab a piece of it, you know, he probably obviously would have a much easier time of dealing with it and would still be alive near the end, you know?
Yeah. I don't see how he could, but if he could have.
Yeah.
I mean, people do surprising things all the time, so.
Yeah. So the other thing to note, too, that I just like to think about as somebody who just likes to watch movies and talk about how all of those pieces that are really important fit together and really just work to tell the same story. One thing that I think is really cool, and it happens throughout the film, but obviously you see it a lot in the opening sequence, and you see it in the sex sequence too, but just the interesting shots paired with like a parallel of what else is happening. The idea that we see a montage like that is so counterintuitive to Hollywood continuity editing. So the idea that you don't see the edits or the cuts, or you don't notice that, you don't notice the cuts, so you're seeing a seamless story being told. And there's nothing about this film that's a seamless story. So everything, what happens is if you're seeing a film that's not following those kind of typical Hollywood standards, it's, they say that, you know, that's a no-no. And they say that that would take you out of an experience of the film. It doesn't do that for me with this film. And it's maybe because it's hit so hard. You get hit so hard at the beginning with that, that you're just, maybe you just get used to the idea that nothing is going to be so easy in this movie, that you're going to have to work a little bit harder than you normally would. And you're going to have to sort of see beyond this like seamless, you know, story unfolding, because it ain't no seamless story. But I love it. And I think that by the time you get to that sex scene, which is still near kind of the beginning of the film, it's really like you end that scene and you're like, you're either, I think, in it or you're out of it. And I don't have an experience of being out of it any watch that I've had. And I think you too, you know, like it just latches you.
I just don't love it. I wish I, like I said, I think it looks like two actors who have just met each other.
Yeah.
Having sex with each other. I mean, not having sex, but simulating sex with each other. And I think that's fine. You could say, well, of course they're awkward with each other because for God's sake, they lost a child and they haven't dealt with it. Yeah. No, that's fine. I can accept that.
I kind of want to go back and watch it with that lens. But I don't, because I kind of love it too, and I don't want to ruin it for me. Yeah, I never noticed the butt touch part or anything like
that. Well, I don't even know if that's there. I could have like filled that in myself, but I just felt like it was awkward. Yeah. And I didn't like it that it was awkward, because I thought these people have been together, we can presume, like how old is that kid? Like 13 or something? They've been together a while.
Yeah.
They know each other's bodies. But to me, it didn't seem like they knew each other's bodies. But that's fine. I mean, I can accept that this event has caused such a rift between them that it would be like discovering each other for the first time.
Yeah.
I'm willing to look at it like that. I just felt distracted.
Okay. Yeah.
Apparently, shooting the drowning sequence was problematic. Sharon Williams, who played Christine, became hysterical when submersed in the pond. And there was a farmer on the neighboring land who volunteered his daughter, who was an accomplished swimmer, but she didn't want to be submersed. And so in the end, The scene was filmed in a water tank using three different girls. And one thing I did notice is he turns his body toward the camera at one part. So I'm not sure if maybe it's a different, you know, a different actor that he's holding at one point.
Yeah.
Donald Sutherland named his son Rogue. Rogue was born in 74 after Nicholas Rogue. His other children are named Rachel and Kiefer, the twins, Rosif and Angus. And I think we talked yesterday about how we both dislike the name Angus. Sorry, Angus is out there.
Did you watch that clip I sent you on?
Yes.
So good.
Colonel Angus?
Yeah. Colonel Angus is coming to town. Things sure can get messy when Colonel Angus comes.
So stupid.
Yeah.
We talked about the danger that Donald Sutherland actually was in that famous scaffolding scene. Daphne du Maurier wrote a letter to Nicholas Rogue after seeing the film, congratulating him on making such a strong film from her story.
I wonder what she...
The film's...
Do you know what she thought of Rebecca?
I don't know what she thought of Rebecca.
Okay.
She wasn't in favor of sex being added to either film.
Huh. Well, she's okay with this. I don't know.
The film's German title is Wenn die Gondeln Trauer tragen, which means when gondolas wear grief.
I love it.
The film's Italian title, A Venezia, un dicembre rosso shocking, translates to In Venice, a shocking red December. Speaking of these different translations of the English title, I wanted to introduce a new segment on the show. I actually introduced it on the zombie show, but this segment is called Come si dice, Don't Look Now in Italiano. And this is where we look at the title of our films in various languages. I won't attempt the languages. I'll just give you the translations. So in Danish, it's Red Shock. In Japanese, it's Red Shadow. In Greek, it's After Midnight. In Portuguese, it's Winter of Blood in Venice. In Norwegian, it's The Deceased Warns.
I don't know.
But your favorite is the German.
I do like the German one, When Gondolas Wear Grief. But I don't know if I like any of them, and I don't know if I love Don't Look Now, because I can't tell you how many times that I keep thinking Don't Look Back or, you know, I don't know. So I'm not sure if I love that title either, but I think that might be the only thing I don't love.
The opening line to the short story is, "Don't look now," John said to his wife, "but there are a couple of old girls two tables away who are trying to hypnotize me."
I love that. That's a fucking fantastic opening sentence.
You crushed it again, Daphne.
Of course, Daphne. Done it again.
I hope you can hear us.
Me too.
Wherever you are. All right, well, briefly, what does Letterboxd have to say about it? James gave it 5 stars. Dead children, weird doppelganger sightings, dramatic Catholic imagery, rich British people, doomsaying old ladies, the blurring of reality and fantasy, thick dreamy fog. Somehow seems like Nicholas Rogue made a film purpose-built to terrify me 30 years before I was born. God, they really knew how to make horror films in the 70s, didn't they?
Yeah.
Born in 2003.
Wow.
2003? God damn it.
Yeah, I had graduated college by then. I was just kind of spinning my wheels in Wilmington that year.
You were doing what?
Spinning my wheels in Wilmington.
Oh, I didn't hear the my parts. I'm like, spinning wheels? What? And then they had this like image of like spinning plates, like in a circus act.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wish that were true. I wish you had been like spinning wheels. Like,
I wish I was like making clothing with a spinning wheel. I wish that's what I meant.
Oh, that would be cool.
Yeah. And I wish like also there were like three fairy godmothers around. I'll even take a curse for a little bit.
Oh, no. You don't want to spin on a cursed spinning wheel.
I mean,
because you could sink into it. A dreamless sleep for like 60 years or some shit.
Yeah, but if my appearance didn't change, I mean, which seemed to be the case for old Sleeping Beauty, I mean, what do I care? How do I have a sense of time if that happens?
Well, you don't. I mean, I guess it'd be just like falling into a coma, but it would really be a bummer to not have you as a friend, to have you as a comatose friend. So just for my sake, don't fuck with cursed spinning wheels, please.
Right. God. I mean, there goes my break plans, but fine. I won't.
Well, listen, Declan Cashin gave it 5 stars. There's really nothing quite like this movie. So startling, original, creepy, weird, shattering.
Beautiful, Declan. Beautiful.
We need to use that word shattering more often, I think.
Yeah.
Genevieve. Or Genevieve gave it 5 stars. I love a slow burn film that devolves into paranoia, tension, anxiety, and overall confusion. Beautiful synchronicity and ideas of premonitions and their effects. Surprisingly cathartic ending.
I love that. I love that. I think that it really is an oddly cathartic ending. And I said this on the Lost pod. This is, to me, like, again, something we both love is a slow burn, but I think this is kind of like the fastest slow burn or the slowest fast burn, whatever. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, it's a short film that feels like because you're following people, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of areas where there's no speaking, no dialogue, whatever. It's all very, you know, direct cinema and like, you're following everyone. It feels slow at times. And people, I think, refer to this as being slow. But it's a fast, slow burn.
It's pretty fast. Especially after the first viewing, I would say.
Yes. Good call.
Ryan Two Chang's. Give it a 0.5 star, Quinn. Mm. I'll say it. I don't care your kid died. Fuck you, Nicholas Rogue, for making this colossal waste of time. Shout out to being innovative for making a boring, quote, elevated horror about trauma that A24 would release like 45 years prior. If boredom is fear, I was terrified by this movie.
Christina, I don't even know what this means. Is he like low-key, like A24, meaning like they would make this 30 years, 45 years before it was made, or like, I mean, it's a production company, so is he, like, really just fucking with...
No, he's saying it's an elevated horror film a la A24. It's the kind of movie that A24 would make today.
Well, I wish that he would have said it, because it's not very clear. His writing is not very clear. And he is a colossal waste of time. Sorry. Quit doing that. I'm just...
We don't care that you wrote this Letterboxd review.
I'll say it.
To Tara Bilmont, gave it 0.5 star. Really Letterboxd. I dare y'all to show or recommend this shit to anyone you're interested in having a real human relationship with, or just anyone that's not in this circle jerk of niche, bizarre, shit tier weirdo movies. That's a beautiful sentence. That's a beautiful sentence.
I've never felt so good about myself.
Or just anyone that's not in the circle jerk of niche, bizarre, shit-tier, weirdo movies.
Shit-tier, weirdo movies.
I think we should name the podcast, change the name of the podcast to that.
I know. I want to, like, next time somebody asks me what I'm into, I'm going to say, shit-tier, weirdo movies. What are you, bitch?
I cannot for the life of me understand what's barely remarkable about this besides the fact that it has an unexpected ending and the year that it came out. Run-of-the-mill everything. Dated. Illogical. At least watchable. And not pretentious. But a waste of time, nonetheless. That took a turn.
Yeah,
I don't... expecting.
I just want to... I just want to say, oh, honey. Who hurt you?
I think that, review had a twist ending.
Yeah. But at least it wasn't pretentious. Just kidding, it was.
Asian America gave it half star. I knew this movie was going to be bad when I saw it was based off a story by Daphne du Maurier. How dare you?
You do not know who you are speaking to. We are
her name
fan.
Out of your fucking mouth.
Get her name out of your fucking mouth. Nice one.
Thank you.
Nice one.
Modern Lights gave it a half star. It was a rewatch. That poor neglected boy.
That's fair.
And honestly, yeah, that's fair.
You know what I was thinking, though?
What?
Going back, if you can go back to the sex scene, do we see full frontal nudity of Donald Sutherland?
I think we get close, but I don't think we see his dong. I hate that word dong. Why did I say that?
Well, then I think we need to hearken back to our old tagline and
more dicks.
More dicks.
I was in the shower earlier, and for some reason I thought of that, more dicks, and how that must have been so confusing to the odd woho who just randomly selected a Quinizone, and hear us at the end of that episode say more dicks.
I think we settled for maybe 6 or 7 episodes after that too.
I know. So anyway, wohos, in case anyone's still listening to this podcast, we want more full frontal male nudity.
We will always want that because we deserve that, because this world is full of full frontal female nudity, but not a lot of full frontal dicks. And that's not fair.
Yeah. Not fair at all. Wohos, thanks for tuning into this bonus mega episode. I am really having fun with this series, and I hope you are too. Coming up on the main show, it's my pick of genre, and I have chosen movies about cults. We will be looking at The Stepford Wives from the US and Kill List from the UK. We are also just about to record our end of the year Fave Sixes show with the whole squad. And this year I'm getting some of my podcast friends together to get their hot takes too. Wohos, get in touch and let me know how you feel about this series and if you have any suggestions for these minis, megas, or the main show. Remember, we love you, and don't go into the basement. That was fun.
Yeah, sorry about the sex stuff.